F.W. Washington.
I've always thought I was being screwed by lenders. Turns out I was right, and so were you. The LIBOR scandal, next on What's at Stake. And good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to What's at Stake. I am Terry DeKester, and as always, it's a privilege to be broadcasting to you this morning. And also, I've got to mention, I'm very pleased to have joining us on the air my colleague, Mark Levine. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Terry.
And as you probably know, and if you don't know, you should know, Mark and I and Garland Nixon also do the Raucous Caucus on Tuesday nights down at Ben's Next Door this whole month of July.
At 7 o'clock p.m.
7 o'clock. So we hope you come down there and come to meet me again and Mark again and Garland, et cetera.
And just listen at 7 o'clock
every
Tuesday night.
Yeah. But I've invited Mark on for a number of reasons. I mean, one, besides the fact that he's a colleague that I respect and have, you know, debated with on every single issue, and, you know, sometimes we actually agree. But Mark also did get a degree in economics from Yale, I believe.
Is that Harvard.
Oh, well, sorry.
Yale Law School.
Oh, geez.
I know.
All right, just stack it up. Anyway, it is a privilege to have Mark with me this morning. And the topic we're going to be discussing, the LIBOR scandal, is probably a bigger scandal and more serious than you or I might think. I don't know about you guys, but a few years back, I don't know how many years back, one of the loans I got for something, I don't know, to buy the motorcycle or whatever, you know, there it was and it fixed, and the rate was determined by the LIBOR index. And as usual, like most people, I said, okay, fine, that sounds good, we'll just go with that. Turns out not so fine. Turns out the LIBOR index is corrupted like so many things in our society.
Why don't you tell them what LIBOR stands for?
Well, I'm going to bring our guest on do that, okay?
Fair
because
enough.
We might as well get it from the experts. And our first guest this morning is going to be and is Richard Wolff, Professor Richard Wolff. Good morning, Professor Wolff. Sorry, he'll be joining us in a moment. We're locating him now. I'm sorry, my mistake on that. It's just a timing question there. But he will be joining us. I'll go ahead and give the information because I know we're going to be able to reach him. He is author of the book, Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. He's a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst, and currently a visiting professor in the graduate program for international affairs at the New School University in New York City. Video of his talk, Capitalism Hits the Fan, is available at www.capitalismhitsthefan.com. He'll be joining us in a moment from New York. Later on in the show, we're going to have another very special guest, and that is Stephanie Griffith-Jones. She is busy in London at this very moment, addressing Parliament, addressing the House of Commons in London, and she will be free to join us as we go on in the show. So while we wait to make contact, let's go ahead and back up a little bit, Mark, and how many loans you got out there based on the LIBOR
index? Pretty much almost every loan in the world in some way is based on something that's based on the LIBOR, which stands for the London Interbank Overnight Rate. That's just a big acronym to make it sound more fancy than it is. But the interesting thing about it, you'll let me know when the guest is on the line, is that it's a pretty new thing.
Yeah, it is. Professor Wolff.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, sir. It's a pleasure to have you on the air, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
Okay. Just because we were a little late on the show and the schedule and everything else, I went ahead and gave all of your credits. You're now famous throughout the Washington, D.C. area, and everybody is running out as soon as the show finishes to buy your book, Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism.
That would be very sweet. Thank you.
Okay. Let's begin at the beginning. We were just beginning to talk about Mark and I. Mark Levine is with me this morning, joining me as co-host. We were just beginning to talk about what actually the LIBOR is. So can you, as our expert this morning, divulge that first?
Yes. Starting about 25 years ago in the mid-'80s, the globalization of credit systems, the vast increase in the use of credit, not just by corporations who had been doing it for a long time and governments, but also the really new thing, the vast new kinds of consumer credit, credit cards above all else, but the auto loans and student loans and all the rest. there became a need for banks and other lenders around the world to have a kind of benchmark interest rate that was the basic interest rate banks charged each other that they did their business in, and then everybody else would graduate their own interest rates. Every lender for a credit card, everyone lending to a person to buy a car or a home, the banker, the lender would set their own rates in relationship to the basic rate that came out of London. And it came out of London only because of the last 200 years, London has been sort of the financial center of the world. So the Bank of England and the British Bankers Association began a process of polling about 15 or 16 major banks, most of them in England, but some beyond, asking them literally every day, how much are you charging each other for the basic flow of money? Posting that result, an average of all of those, and then the rest of the world used that average to make up their own minds about how much they would charge for the money they lent out. So in effect, a group of people, a very cozy, small club, because we're talking about the world's biggest banks here, 15 of them, their leading officials sat down with the leading officials of the Bank of England and the British Bankers Association, people they knew personally and probably interacted with socially, and they set an interest rate which affected, for example, you and me and all the listeners in countless ways. Not just how much we paid monthly on our credit card or how much we paid the bank for mortgages or so forth, but since most corporations borrow, whatever they had to pay was passed on to the prices we pay for whatever those corporations produce. So in effect, this small group of people had found their way into a position of stupefying economic power because they could affect literally every price on the planet by what they did in this casual relationship they had developed, very cozy, over the years. And they've been doing that, as I say, for 25 years. It's now become a scandal for two simple reasons. First, the crisis that hit world capitalism in 2007 and 2008 put everybody in a very, very difficult position, including these banks. So, like everyone else trying to cope with an economic crisis that threatened to overwhelm and destroy everybody, they looked around for whatever they could do to enhance their survival, to make it possible to get through this crisis. And that became, of course, worse and worse as the crisis deepened rather than passed. And so what we now know is that these bankers saw a chance to improve their own situations by manipulating these rates, by not being altogether honest, I'm being polite here, in what they reported to the British Bank Association and the Bank of England, shading the amounts of interest that they were charging each other, or at least what they said they were doing. This helped them enormously and left the rest of us to suffer the consequences, whatever they were, of how these people took care of business at their lofty peak at the top of the financial system. The second thing that happened is as the crisis got worse and worse and they were doing these shenanigans, there began to be a demand across the world for who's to blame for all of this, above all the crisis and the fact that we're now in the fifth year of it and the fact that there's no end in sight and the fact that government policies have simply failed to get us out of it. Now there's a lot of scapegoating, finger-pointing, and someone ratted out, and no one will ever know who it was, someone made it clear that this is going on, that these are great candidates for being the bad guys, and so to save himself or herself, whoever did this, opened the can of worms, and now we all get to see what you might want to call, if you were a nasty person, a falling out among thieves. They're exposed. And now everybody gets a chance to point the finger at them because they were clearly doing things that were unethical, inappropriate, unjust, and it looks like we will see them also be designated as illegal. One of the biggest players, Barclays Bank, one of the largest banks in the world and one of the largest in England, has already admitted it because they have paid a fine, roughly $450 million in fines so far for having done this, that they've paid to regulatory authorities in both England and the United States, leaving, of course, two questions. One, what else do these people do on a regular basis that we don't know about, that they're in a position to do, that will come out now or maybe never come out? And what are we doing allowing this amount of power over this many dimensions of our economic lives to be concentrated in the hands of a few people able to do this sort of thing?
That is an excellent summary, and I really thank you for that. And
no,
that's exactly what our listeners needed to hear. Again, we're speaking to Professor Richard Wolff. Professor Wolff, given this situation, I like us to be as specific as possible without, you know, casting aspersions, but just which are the banks, which American banks, and which banks are involved in the setting of the LIBOR rate, whether they were doing their work honestly or whether they were manipulating it? And the second question is a follow-up, as I just read this morning, that the Barclays is now claiming that they were in touch with the New York Federal Bank, with Timony Geithner was in charge of at that time, and were telling them since 2007 that, well, there might be something wrong.
The New York Federal Reserve, the regulators.
Yeah. So, but which banks specifically are we talking about? Again, not accusing ones that, you know, necessarily we don't have any proof that they've done anything wrong, but which banks are the ones in this 15 or whatever that are actually setting these rates, and which American banks, of course?
Well, that is complicated. Every American bank in one way or another, or any sizable American bank in one way or another, uses the LIBOR rates. And every American bank of any size, being a player typically on both the supply of money and the lending of money and the borrowing of money, everyone in a sense plays a role in shaping whatever it is that the actual interest rates among the biggest banks are, and therefore is involved in shaping the LIBOR, just as they are all involved heavily in using the LIBOR in figuring out the rates they charge.
Doesn't that imply that therefore they would be somewhat aware of this manipulation?
At the highest levels, there's no question in my mind.
Wow.
You know, I wasn't present at the meeting. I can't, you know, stand up in a court of law and say I saw, I heard.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, it is unthinkable that the highest officials of the largest banks and people like Mr. Geithner and others at the peak of the regulatory system such as the Federal Reserve operates, and the New York Bank is particularly important because it has responsibility, especially that other Federal Reserve banks do not have, for the international transactions of the American banking system. Let me also comment for a moment on Mr. Geithner's particular vulnerability here. Barclays Bank, which again is the one we can name because they have admitted doing this business of not reporting accurately or manipulating the rates, they've admitted it. They've paid, as I say, a $450 million fine already. They may be in trouble and have to pay more. So let's use them. Barclays is important because at the key moment of the financial crisis, which happened in the last third of 2008, when there was real anxiety on Wall Street and around the world that the entire financial system was about to crash, and that the reason it was about to crash was that the Federal Reserve had decided to allow one of the largest investment banks in the world, Lehman Brothers, to basically go belly up, declare bankruptcy, which it did. And that had terrible ramifications, frightening every bank in the world that if something as old, traditional, rich, and powerful as Lehman had collapsed, then who knew who would be next? So in that moment, the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, playing a crucial role together with the Treasury in Washington, allowed Lehman not only to collapse, and here comes the big part, also arranged that to minimize or at least to lessen the economic fallout from the collapse of Lehman, they would sell a huge portion of Lehman's operations to Barclays Bank of England.
How convenient.
Yes. And so in order to induce Barclays to buy a bank which was in trouble, obviously, they made one of those offers you can't refuse. They gave it to Barclays at a fraction of what Barclays would otherwise have had to pay, which is why Barclays was willing to do it. And those conversations then had to happen, and very many of them, between Mr. Geithner and Mr. Diamond, the CEO, a former American citizen who became British, a former CEO who had to resign last week from Barclays. These were the point men, the key guys, who sat down and discussed every aspect of one of the greatest financial transactions in the history of the modern world. And in those conversations, interest rates set by LIBOR would have been a central part of every calculation made about what this would mean, what this should cost, and so on.
Let me just clarify that point, because that is so important. You're saying that Geithner, Diamond, head of Barclays, et cetera, American banks in New York City, Citigroup or Citibank, J.P. Morgan, all of these guys would have been talking about this and would have been talking about, included in their conversations, the LIBOR rate, which we now know is basically been fixed. Am I interpreting that correctly?
That's about right.
Wow.
They would have had to deal with all of that. The notion that there could have been what is now alleged, namely years of such manipulation, even before the crisis hit, and then more intensive manipulation because of the crisis, to imagine that these people who were talking to each other hourly on some days and all the time, making enormous decisions, which we ought to question anyone being in a position to do, especially to do in the cozy, secret atmosphere of literally handfuls of people, to imagine that they had no idea about this. You might also want to know that back in 2008, there were questions raised by the Securities and Exchange Commission here and others about the question of how these LIBOR rates were set.
Hmm.
In other words, this is not an altogether new phenomena. That if you go back and do a little research, you'll see that these kinds of questions have been raised, and then they tended to show up for a few days on the financial pages of a few newspapers, and then they got buried. I personally have no doubt in my mind that the hope of Barclays in paying $450 million in fines, that their hope was that this would all go away and that the paying of the fine would once again bury this whole situation with no further fallout. That's been disappointed, and so they're having to fire their top executives.
Yeah.
But, if one last key thing. This is a system that is responding to, this is a scandal that responds to enormous incentives in the system to do this and enormous rewards for the people who do it. And unless you change that basic system, those incentives, those rewards, banks that are so big that they can actually move on these incentives and reap these rewards, if you don't change the basic system, then punishing Bob Diamond or Mr. Agius or Mr. Geithner, that isn't going to change anything, however satisfying it might be to see some of these big guys looking sad and troubled on a TV screen. The next ones are going to be subject to exactly the same incentives and rewards.
And
we would be naive to expect different outcomes.
I want to bring Mark Levine in this. I just want to pick up a quick quote from the paper this morning, again stressing your point, Professor Wolf. The bank, that's Barclays, agreed to pay $453 million to American and British regulators to end investigations into the scandal.
Okay, I hadn't seen that, but yes, I'd literally confirmed.
Yeah, okay. Mark Levine, jump in.
Yeah,
here,
Professor Wolf, I have a degree in economics, and I'm well familiar with the LIBOR rate. I for years, I know virtually every financial transaction transaction in the world is based in some way. It could be LIBOR plus one or LIBOR plus two,
right,
but it's related to LIBOR. But the thing that shocked me, and I'm sort of embarrassed, I guess, that I didn't know this until this scandal happened, is that, you know, the name London Interbank Overnight Rate, I had thought that the
offered rate. Anyway, go ahead.
Excuse me, which rate?
The actual word is offered.
Offered rate. Okay.
But you're right. It's for overnight lending among banks.
Well, I had thought that the LIBOR was something that could empirically be determined. In other words, you would take all the transactions that are being done between banks overnight for interest and add them all up, find an average, and boom, that was the LIBOR. What shocked me was learning that it wasn't based on some objective way to measure these transactions, but it's based basically on calling these 15 banks and saying, what'd you charge overnight? And they could tell you it's a certain interest rate, and they could actually do something else. It wasn't an empirical rate.
That's right.
And that shocked me. And my question for you, number one, is this: was this well known outside the industry? I mean, did you know this 10, 15, 20 years ago? And the second question I have is, how can manipulating the rates, how can saying one rate and offering another actually provide a lot of money to these banks? Those are my two questions.
Okay, first question. Honestly, I did not. And this is, you know, I'm a professor of economics.
Well, good.
I'm supposed to know these
things. Then I don't feel so bad.
Yeah,
we don't feel guilty.
Yeah. I would say that the number of people who had a clear sense of the precise mechanism could fit in the inside a reasonable sized living room. That's right. All of us knew was that it was a basic rate that was the center of the financial world of what's called the city in London, and that it was a pretty good proxy for what short-term, overnight, and a few-day loans among major banks, what that was costing, and that's how the basis of interest rates gets set. That's what we knew. So we didn't know that it was not based on some numerical average. We didn't know that it was a clubby conversation in which bankers were being asked their opinion about what these things were and where they were going and so forth. So you're absolutely in the overwhelming majority, 99.99%.
I feel better. Thank you, Professor.
We didn't know.
Okay.
Number two, the basic problem is this. The bank that is whose chief executive, some monster bank, whose chief executive is among the 15 or 16 who are polled all the time to form the LIBOR. It's an average, basically, by the way, of what these big banks say. And by the way, an average which drops the highest and the lowest off calculating the average. In any case, it's a system in which these banks who are making these statements that shape the LIBOR are at the same time among the biggest players in the world on many of the financial instruments whose profitability will depend on what that LIBOR is.
Of course.
So they are making loans, they are making credit swaps, they are making interest rate swaps, credit default swaps, all kinds of investments whose profitability for that bank will be shaped by what the LIBOR is said to be.
That's like playing blackjack in Vegas, getting to choose my own cards. That's
yes,
really
exactly
nice.
Right.
Or,
exactly
or
right.
Put your cousin in the position of whoever's spinning the wheel, et
yeah.
cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Another way is that the bank's own well-being, how well capitalized the bank is, how difficult it may be for it to cash in on its holdings of debt instruments, will likewise be affected if, for example, the LIBOR rate is lower, if they say it's lower than it actually is, well, then the price of the bonds they possess will correspondingly be higher.
That's
the way that system works. They know that, of course. And so what you're having is a group of people with a clear interest in the outcome making the decision on what that outcome is, and that's considered to be, everywhere else in the world, a fundamental conflict of interest.
Let me ask this, Professor Wolfen, only because I know that you have other obligations that are going to have to leave us here shortly.
Right.
As succinctly as you can, given your time frame, time schedule, how do we separate the banks and government? I mean, you know, how do we annul this incestuous marriage that they are involved in? You know, what would be the number one or number two or three steps that we could take to separate this insidious, incestuous marriage between banks and government?
Well, the first thing is we have allowed, all of us, whether it's the United States, Britain, or many, many other countries, we've allowed banks to become of a size that they literally overwhelm anything and everything that's done to control them. We know that. We just had a debate over recent years in which a central concept was called too big to fail. We've actually made the banks that were too big to fail when this crisis began even bigger now than they were then. I mean, it is craziness. Bank of America and Merrill Lynch were two separate entities in 2007. They're now the same company in 2012. They got bigger, not smaller. And we are putting them in a position of controlling resources faced with incentives and rewards that are producing these outcomes. So the first thing that has to be done is to confront the impossibility in a democratic society and in a functioning economy of allowing accumulations of wealth and power on this scale that are able not only to bring us into a crisis, but then to manipulate key parts of the system during the crisis to give them a better shot of coming out of it whole than the rest of us can afford or can find. Number two, the cozy relationship between bank and regulators on the one hand and these agglomerations of wealth cannot be sustained. There has to be a radical increase in the numbers of people from all walks of life that are involved on a daily basis in these discussions, in these rate settings, so that it can't be the tiny number of people who could pull off a global trillion-dollar level scam like this. We have to have a much more democratic accountability, both at the government level and the bank level, if we're going to avoid this. And finally, we really ought to question whether the gains, and there are some, that come from huge agglomerations of credit on the one hand, and the abuses that we are now living through, by the way, the fifth year of this crisis with no end in sight, whether we don't have to question this is a system that doesn't work anymore. And, you know, I understand it frightens people to hear that. But the alternative is to live with a system that isn't working anymore, that isn't providing jobs. You know, today I read of the bankruptcy of Scranton, Pennsylvania,
yes,
and San Bernardino, California.
Yeah.
These are cities that are among our biggest. There are over 200,000 people in these places. You know, this is a system that doesn't function on so many levels that then when we hear that there's this shenanigan at the top, it really ought to take us over the edge and realize we've got to change the system. We've got to renew the debate about capitalism, because if we don't, we're all going to go down with a ship that
very
doesn't
quickly,
work anymore.
Very quickly, Professor, and then we do have to, I know you have to get to your next engagement, and we have to take a break here, but very quickly, does the Dodd-Frank bill do any of this?
No.
That's what
little,
I was afraid.
It is too late. It is being watered down in all the details as the regulators work them out. The banks are in there using the money that the government bailed them out with to make sure that the government that bailed them out isn't in a position to constrain their ability to make money. And that's the way this system works. And until we change it, we're not going to see the kind of alternatives that we're desperate for.
Professor Richard Wolff, thank you so very much for educating us and clarifying the situation for us this morning on What's at Stake. We really appreciate your participation.
No problem. My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you. Again, Professor Wolff is the author of the book, Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. And as you can hear from what we have just gone through today, we got to challenge capitalism. We got to challenge the government. We got to challenge the banks. The system is shot. And you and I are getting screwed, to put it very bluntly. I am Terry D. Kester, and my guest this morning helping me out is Mark Levine. We will be back in just a few minutes with our guest from London on What's at Stake on WPFW 89.3 FM Pacifica.
Ella Fitzgerald, John Coltrane, Wynton Marsalis, can you imagine a world without them? WPFW is committed to preserving the cultural heritage of America's classical music, jazz. Hi, I'm Andy Shalal, owner of Busboys and Poets and Edenville Restaurant, and chairman of the Circle of Excellence in Radio. To ensure the continuation of quality cultural programming at WPFW, please consider joining the Circle of Excellence with a gift of $1,000 or more. For more information, call 202-588-0999, extension 344, or visit us online today at wpfw.org.
And good morning once again. This is Terry D. Kester. This is What's at Stake on WPFW 89.3 FM Pacifica. And no, I cannot calm down. I'm not going to calm down as long as I keep on getting educated by guests like we've just had discussing the LIBOR situation. Again, that was Professor Richard Wolff, and we thank him for joining us on What's at Stake. And once again, helping me out this morning is Mark Levine. Hello, Mark, again.
Hello again, Terry.
Good to have you on the show here.
I'm not used to seeing you in the morning. Usually we're in the evenings.
I'm not sure we could go any further about this. I'm not sure what you're saying. What he is referring to is Mark and I, along with Garland Nixon, do host the show Raucous Caucus on Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. And we're doing it this month down at Ben's Next Door for the whole month of July on Tuesday nights at 7. Please come and join us and meet us live. The rest of the time we're here in the studio and doing it and taking in your phone calls. That's the Raucous Caucus on Tuesday nights. Yes, Mark?
For those that don't know, Ben's Next Door is next door to Ben's Chili Bowl.
Yes.
1211 U Street Northwest. We'd love to have you come down. We're up in the back. Just come up to the mezzanine and join us. And, of course, you get a great chance to talk on the air as well as enjoy fine dining while listening to radio.
And with that upbeat note, now we go back to harsh reality. And our next guest, is Professor Stephanie Griffith Jones. Good morning, Miss Jones.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, and thank you for joining us all the way from London. Stephanie Griffiths-Jones is the Financial Markets Program Director at Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. And she has co-edited Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. And she has just finished, as I understand your schedule, Ms. Jones, addressing Parliament. And I guess my first question, because I'm pretty sure it was about this issue, what did you tell Parliament?
Well, I told them that the financial sector has to be very closely regulated. That it also has to be taxed. That we have to split the more speculative part of banking, like you have the Volcker Rule in the U.S., and have it very tight. The recent events have shown us even more clearly that we need a radical reform of the financial sector because it is clearly not fit for purpose. It doesn't serve the needs of the real economy, and it creates risk instead of managing risk, which is what it's supposed to do.
And I know that London has been, and I guess still is, one of the financial centers, if not the financial center of the entire world. I also know that the banks there, at least as I understand it, have been relatively unregulated. Is Parliament going to do anything? Because it's not about just England, obviously, and the United Kingdom. It's about the United States. It's about the entire world financial system. I think you pointed out that this affects something like $500 trillion worth of investments, etc. Is Parliament going to do anything?
Well, the British say that their regulations are actually tighter than the European regulations. I think this is true in some aspects. It certainly was not the case in the past. The UK and the US led this wave of deregulation, which has ended in this disastrous results. But now there is quite a lot of resolve in the UK and within the European Union to tighten up regulation. It is, of course, always being undermined by lobbying and other pressures from the financial sector, of which you also have a lot of experience in the United States, where the financial sector has been undermining and trying to water down the very good regulation that Dodd-Frank produced.
Well, clarify that a bit more, just in one sense, if you would. And again, we're speaking to Stephanie Griffith-Jones from London. Is the United States regulation better or worse than what is what exists now in England? I mean, are we behind the curve or are we ahead of the curve? Where do we stand in terms of regulation in the and the world financial system?
I think now, I mean, previously, of course, as shown by the fact that you had this major crisis with the subprime that multiplied all across the world, clearly the U.S. was very far behind good regulation. I think after the crisis, the Dodd-Frank bill is a very important attempt at regulating the financial sector, especially if it is fully implemented. I think there's still a lot of details that have to be finalized, and there's still a lot of lobbying, and I'm not sure if depends a bit on the result of the next presidential election that it is not undermined further. But if it is fully implemented, for example, the Volcker Rule, which aims to separate more speculative activities from bread-and-butter banking, then that will be a significant step forward.
And they, as you pointed out, that is being lobbied against by billions of dollars from the banks. Mark, jump in.
Yeah, Professor Jones, it's interesting because we just had Professor Richard Wolff on, and he gave a very powerful analysis of the LIBOR crisis. And his view was that Dodd-Frank was too little too late, is the exact words that he used. Maybe you can help resolve a difference between my friend Terry and me, because we've argued about this a long time.
Yes, we have.
I've argued that the Dodd-Frank bill and the Volcker Rule was a good step forward, if not far enough. Terry tends to argue that it's hopelessly, I'll let you use your own words.
Well, yeah, not hopeless, but that
near far enough.
Even if it were enacted as written, it is still a little too weak, and it is being undermined in so many ways.
No, I agree it's being undermined.
That it's practically useless.
I think that it's a very wise colleague of mine say the glass can be either half full or half empty.
Okay.
I think the intention of Dodd-Frank was good, and the result was, I think, better than expected by people who are progressive and who want the financial sector regulated. But it is still insufficient. I would really agree with that. For example, the Volcker Rule allows banks to have up to 3% of their capital invested in hedge funds. And that sounds very low, but if we think how highly leveraged hedge fund activity is,
yes,
in fact, that ratio is very high. And so it should be, if anything, be tightened up significantly. Now, people like Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan went around saying that it was too tight and that it should be loosened up, watered down. Of course, now, because the banks have taken care of all the problems. But, of course, then when the scandal erupted in J.P. Morgan, where they lost up to $8 or $9 billion, his argument is severely weakened.
Yes.
And the same happens with the Barclays scandal, which you've already discussed, this crucial rate, which affects transactions of $500 trillion, partly derivatives, but also the mortgages of you and me, the student loans of our kids, our credit card bills, is determined in this market. And that market has been rigged because it was left to bankers. And, they can't behave, and everything has to, again, be regulated.
Professor Jones, can the United States do anything about that? The LIBOR, we are now learning, is set by 15 or 16 banks, mostly in London, a few perhaps in the United States. To what extent, and we do hope the UK does the right thing over there in London, to what extent can we in the United States do anything about this kind of collusion? Because Dodd-Frank, for all its good or bad parts, I don't think addresses LIBOR at all, does it?
No.
I don't think so. I mean, this is a new problem, although the regulators seem to have been investigated for some time, and they were rigging it since 2005. One interesting question is, why are the regulators so slow in picking up the problems? But I think, being more forward-looking, we have to find, I think, a method, like Gary Gensler was saying in the United States, in the CFTC, for example, separating those who trade and benefit from this fixing, from those who give the information, have clear information, not estimates, but clear data transactions based. And if this is not possible with LIBOR, try and find a more objective rate, maybe U.S. Treasury bills or something like that could be possible to make this market transparent and not subject to rigging.
I think
the more bankers cheat on the rules that they have themselves, we have to recur, whether we like it or not, to tighter regulation, because we can't have a malfunctioning, dysfunctional financial system that creates scandal after scandal and crisis after crisis. We have to get on with the business of banks, which is quite simple, which is to channel excess savings to investors and to households.
You know, it's interesting that you point out we can't have this kind of crisis after crisis, and as you know, in our silly political, and I do mean silly political system right now in America, of course, everybody is complaining about the uncertainty, which is government's fault, when in reality the uncertainty is created by these banks, and they have been creating the uncertainty and the chaos from the very beginning. But you mentioned a little bit about, you know, the individual person, and that's kind of what I want to focus on for a moment from your perspective, Professor Jones. You know, what is the effect on, let me put it this way, a little broader actually, the effect of this scandal, what is the effect of this scandal likely to cause? I mean, obviously, you know, our Congress is going to pick it up and make it into a sideshow as usual, but it's going to spread. It's extremely important, individual and or on the worldwide economy at this point with these revelations.
Well, I think the first point you made is also very important in the sense that in the U.S. and even more in the Eurozone, people are saying, oh, these governments who manage badly and they have caused the crisis. But in fact, it's so obvious that the crisis was initially caused both in the U.S. and in Europe and previous crises in developing countries by the financial sector. So if the cause of these crises is unregulated finance, we have to address the main cause of the crisis and regulate and tax it properly. So I think this is a very important point to make, because people get a little bit confused, and politicians, particularly more conservative ones, you know, feed this idea that it's government failure, when in fact it's the most outrageous market failure that we've had since the Second World War.
Yeah, I would argue the only government failure is the extent that it's police not catching the criminals. You can blame government for not regulating these very bad guys, but for the criminals themselves to blame the cops for not catching them for breaking the law is a little bit hypocritical, I would say.
Good metaphor, Mark. But expressing it again, you know, where is this going to lead to? What kind of economic fallout is this going to have? Because this is huge.
Well, the thing is, it's already affected lots of people, because the interest rates that have been charged on our savings account that we get paid, or the bills on our insurance, have not been the correct ones. So there may be masses of legal cases, court cases brought up by individuals against the banks or by companies, and that will again disrupt the system.
Professor.
Perfectly legitimate. I think it will lead perhaps to a strengthening towards good financial regulation. I think the succession of scandals, and in the UK there have been others as well, selling of derivatives to very small companies that didn't understand them, and that led to losses and sometimes to bankruptcies and so on. I think we'll reinforce the hand of people like us who believe in good regulation.
Are we at a point, though, giving, and I don't want to overstress this, because I certainly don't want to contribute to panic in any sense whatsoever, nor do I believe in the necessity of panic, which is a strange statement to make, but nevertheless, I don't. But, you know, given the precarious situation of our financial system in the country and in the United States and the political turmoil that surrounds that precariousness, I mean, is this going to affect the markets? Is this going to, the scandal going to affect investing? Is this scandal going to, in other words, take us further or closer to the edge?
I would hope not. Particularly, I think, if clear steps are taken towards appropriate regulation. I think it will strengthen, as I said, for example, there's this idea in the UK, there's the Vickers Report, which is in some ways the equivalent of the Volcker Rule, or what was done in the United States in the 1930s, the Glass-Steagall Act, which is to try and separate the kind of bread and butter banking that does what it should, from more speculative aspects. So I think there will be a reinforcing of that, and there will be a search for either improving the indicator, LIBOR, regulating it properly, or the fixing of it, so that it reflects facts and not fictions, or it may eventually be replaced by another interest rate. Obviously, the timing is not good. We're in the middle of the Eurozone crisis, but I don't think it should have a significant effect in terms of creating lack of confidence of investors.
So your position is, if anything, it should encourage the regulation that we need at this point.
Exactly.
Professor, it was reported in the press that one of the purposes of the $453 million fine that Barclays paid was to encourage investigators to stop looking into what Barclays had done, to sort of pay them off, to get them off the scent. That concerned me that this might actually, the money payment might actually lead to less regulation. I want you to comment on that, if you would, and also on your belief as a comparison between Glass-Steagall in the 30s, Volcker from a couple years ago, and whatever the British are trying to do now, the Vickers report, what you believe is the best way to regulate this thing, or maybe in some combination. So those two questions, please.
I think your second question is really important. I actually believe that one should have a stepped-up Vickers report implementation, which is as similar as possible in our current circumstances to what the Glass-Steagall Act did, because the Glass-Steagall led to 30, 40 years of a period when there were practically no banking and financial crises. So it was
is Volcker as good? How do you compare the Volcker rule to Glass-Steagall or the Vickers report?
I think Volcker rule is good. It's unfortunate that it has these exceptions, like allowing the sort of more utility banks to also have hedge fund transactions. And so there's a little bit of vagueness there, which I think needs to be clarified. But I think it's of course, very important to implement it as fully as possible.
And then the first question about, is Barclays going to stop the regulation by payment of this fine?
Or is the government?
No, I don't think
government.
So, because also Barclays is going, I'm sure they tried that, but Barclays is also going to be prosecuted criminally by the Serious Fraud Office, which is a very important step. And individuals may also face criminal prosecutions in the United States. Interestingly, they were given exemption in the U.S. from the bank was given exemptions in the U.S. from criminal prosecution as part of this deal. I don't find that very good. One good thing is that they were also asked to, they will have to apparently regulate other banks doing kind of good practice in this LIBOR fixing. So they're trying to kind of use the banks themselves to also self-regulate as well as regulation.
Yeah, self-regulation.
It may be interesting, but I'm not sure how well it will work.
Let me back up a little bit, Professor Jones. I mean, you said that banks or some banks were exempted from some regulation or oversight. I want to know specifically which, are you referring to American banks, English banks, or whichever, which banks were exempted and who or what agency exempted them?
No, they were exempted from Barclays. Was exempted from criminal prosecution in the United States.
But by whom?
They were fined by your regulators, by the Department of Justice and by the CFTC.
Which is
good, but they were exempted as a bank from criminal prosecution. Individuals from that bank, like their executives, can be fined.
Can they be prosecuted, but not
the bank itself. I found that, which was not very much reported, but it was mentioned in the press, I found that a little bit worrying. Why exempt a bank from criminal prosecution in the U.S.? But it will actually be prosecuted now. The case will be examined by the Serious Fraud Office, which is, I think, a very good thing.
And that's in the United States that'll be investigated.
No, that's in the United Kingdom.
I mean, this is concerning because, you know, again, maybe this writing in the paper today is a little bit sloppy, but it does say that the agreement, literally the agreement to pay the fine, is that there will not be, to end, is literally the verb used, to end investigation. So, I mean, I know that Congress is making some noise about hearings, but that's just noise. You know, does that mean our Justice Department or our Treasury Department agreed there'll be no more investigation?
No, they didn't agree to no more investigation. I mean, there will certainly be investigations in the UK. And in fact, there was a dispute in the United Kingdom because what the government has imposed with its majority in the parliament is that the investigation will be done through parliamentary inquiry. What the opposition, the Labour Party, wanted was a more general inquiry, broader ranging inquiry, and one led by a judge. So it would have been a judicial inquiry, which I think would have been better.
Yeah.
Professor Jones, I wonder if you'd comment on our Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, because the reports that he was talking with Barclays when he was head of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York in 2007 about fixing the LIBOR. What do you know about his personal role in any of this?
No, I don't know. I don't know about his personal role. I haven't even read the newspaper report.
Yeah, unfortunately, that will simply become another political issue in this country, and Tim Geithner will be forced out, no doubt.
I think he will.
I think it's a little bit unfortunate because, you know, whatever one thinks of him, I don't think this kind of political football. We saw it here last week, where the conservatives who have, you know, always opposed financial regulation and who kept criticizing Labour for regulating too much were criticizing the shadow Treasury spokesman for not having regulated LIBOR properly. And in fact, the kind of things that were being said by the current chancellor were proved to be false. So I think it's bad to focus so much on personalities and what people did or didn't do, particularly people in government. I think governments and legislators have to focus on how to fix the system so it doesn't happen again, how to mend it.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah, there's a great deal of wisdom in that because, I mean, what we tend to do, of course, with media-driven for the most part and politically-driven is we want to focus on personalities, we want to oversimplify it, and therefore we don't have to address the major issues and the crises in the system. Well, Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, I want to thank you so very much for joining us this morning on What's at Stake. I really appreciate not only your joining us, and also I appreciate your work that you are doing in England and before Parliament. And I see you're connected with Columbia University. Are you going to come over here and address our Congress and our Senate?
If they invite me, I would certainly be delighted. We will continue working at Columbia University to try and provide policy alternatives to the kind of mainstream policies which are clearly not working, particularly in the financial system.
Amen. Well, thank you again, Professor Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, and joining us from London. Thank you
Pleasure
so much.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Whoa, Mark, I tell you, I mean, you know, it seems to just get worse and worse, although I guess maybe the good news is if we pay attention, and I know our listeners will pay attention, you know, that this can be really something to inspire some of the regulation that we need and to get them off their butts. Your comments just
right. It was interesting to me because obviously Professor Wolf and Professor Jones were very much on the same page with regard to the facts. But I don't know. I was encouraged more by the tone, I guess, of Professor Jones because, you know, Professor Wolf told us all the bad stuff and got us really scared. But Professor Jones, who admitted all the bad stuff, did talk about ways to fix it, whether it's Volcker Rule or what's going on in the United Kingdom. And it seems to me that there is some hope. Maybe I'm always looking for a little bit of hope.
But
we can fix it and that the goal should be to have as few exemptions to Volcker as possible. The Volcker Rule, of course, is part of the Dodd-Frank bill that helps separate a bank's speculative activities from their regular banking activities. Even as horrible as it is, it gives me some hope that there are ways to fix this, that if we as a public watch very carefully, we can encourage the process.
Well, you know, I mean, you actually bring up an important point, and I don't disagree with you that because, I mean, it can be. But the one question I wanted to ask Ms. Jones, and we ran out of time to ask it, was simply how is the public reacting there and what is the public pressure? The point being that Americans really have to pressure Congress again on this. Today in today's paper, besides the articles on the LIBOR, is also an article about the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which has voted 4-1 to to a definition of swap and therefore regulations
that's
and define
so
it
important.
And
people don't know what that means. Remember that before the 1980s, there was no such thing as a swap. There were things called insurance contracts and so forth. And then some very crafty people at some high levels of financial places on Wall Street said, well, we're going to call this thing a swap because if we call it insurance, it's regulated. If we call it banking, it's regulated. We're going to call it a credit derivative swap. And suddenly there were $60 trillion unregulated. So they're finally closing this loophole. Now that the Wall Street people won't look for other loopholes, but it's very important for Americans to be watching these things, because if we don't watch it, I guarantee you some billionaire on Wall Street is going to find a way around it.
Yeah, and we've got to, you know, I think we really have to start putting pressure on people like Timothy Geithner.
Absolutely.
And, you know, Holder
the
or whoever.
The Obama administration has got, it's got to be held accountable. It's not just Congress.
And deliberate. I mean, we should be calling and writing them as well
because
as our Congress.
Here's the thing. Dodd-Frank gave some very strong parameters, but it is up to the administration, the SEC and the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, the Federal Reserve. It's up to the Obama administration, in effect, to interpret this bill. And as you heard Professor Jones point out, there's still leeway. There's still room here to make this as strong as possible. Interestingly, this is one of the few things that actually Obama can do without Congress. Congress has done what it can with Dodd-Frank. If we push the administration, call the president, tell him you want Timothy Geithner to have as stringent possible regulations, just that one phone call from millions of Americans could make the difference in protecting
us
from future crisis.
I mean, and then to support that, the article continues, and I want to read this, is very important. The regulators of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission have voted to define, to create transparencies with swaps, credit default swaps, et cetera, derivatives, all of this. They've voted to get these rules and definitions. I'm quoting from the paper now, from Reuters. The regulators moved ahead with their rules, even though Treasury Secretary Timothy F. Geithner has not finalized a proposed decision to exempt foreign exchange swaps and forwards from central clearing and exchange trading requirements. You, citizens, me, Mark, et cetera, we have to write Timothy Geithner and say, we know what you're doing. We know what you've done. We don't approve. We don't support you. Anything less than restoring Glass-Steagall, at least in principle, I don't care if you call it the same thing or not, but at least in principle and in enforcement, you know, is meaningless. You've got to do this.
What I liked hearing from Professor Jones and is that I think the Volcker Rule really can replace pretty much Glass-Steagall. It's modernized. It's not a 1930s thing, and that's good. It should be modernized. It has to include things like swaps that didn't exist in the 1930s, but that a strong Volcker Rule without exemptions or with as few exemptions as possible can replace the 40, 50 years of stability we've had since the Glass-Steagall Act was passed in the 1930s. We can actually get better, but it's up to the citizens of the United States and the UK to press their governments to watch Wall Street.
And to say specifically, when you're writing the president or when you're writing Timothy Geithner or calling either one or Holder or whomever, that, you know, the exemptions are part of the problem, and we don't want to see these exemptions. You've got to stop giving exemptions. There are so many exemptions already written into all of these bills. Dodd-Frank has been weakened. These regulations have already been weakened. I can give you one very quick example, that if you are forming a derivative or a hedge fund, rather, and involving in that, you can keep you don't have to report what you're doing, even under current regulations as proposed now, for if it's, quote, sort of in the family, but they extend the family to go back 15 generations, which would include...
It's kind of the family like the mafia family.
Exactly. Right. You know, so you've got to be saying to our leaders, stop exempting, because the lobbying pressure to create exemptions is phenomenal.
And it's done quietly. And one of the things Elizabeth Warren always points out, and I love Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren for president in 2016.
Amen.
But she points out that even though Dodd-Frank was done very clearly under the public glare with a lot of pressure and Congress finally caved, all these are being done in secret. They're going, they're spending billions of dollars, they're talking to the regulators. This isn't being made public, and it's up to the public to insist that we know about these things.
And I do think, without getting into the blame game, and I'm going to wrap it up here, Mark. And again, thank you so very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me here. It's fun being with you in the morning and not just in the Raucous Caucus, Tuesday nights at 7.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the things that irritates me about this is I think we do have to prosecute individuals. I think that's part of it. It's essential in terms of any kind of justice whatsoever. The fact that Diamond can simply retire and walk away with millions of dollars still for severance pay and billions of dollars he's already gotten, even though he has been the center of this crime, there's no question about that. Any of you you who have worked in retail know that for the most part, if you're off a dollar or two at your cash register, you have to pay that. Often you simply get fired by companies if you're off a buck or something like that. These guys walk away and get paid extra. Somehow their justice is a big part of this. Justice is always part of what we do here on What's at Stake, and we encourage you to fight. The point is to never give up. I am not a pessimist. I believe that there is hope, but there's hope because we keep on fighting. I am Terry D. Kester. It's a privilege to be